Live from Burbank, California, where America comes to burn flags, it's the Mark Maron Show. And now, show me where Jay Leno touched you. Mark Maron.
Here and here. Good evening, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, lurking conservatives, need machines, pain sponges, and my friends, the blog community at markmaron.com, who I blogged with last night and had a nice time.
Christopy, Orbit Boy.
Yeah, they were all there. Everyone was there.
And Jay Johnston.
MRD in NYC.
Narco.
Got under my skin. Hey, folks, got a good show today. I'm not gonna lie. Got a good show. We got Amy Sedaris and Paul Dinello from the new film Strangers with Candy. We got John Amato from Crooks and Liars, old buddy. We got Congressman John Tierney from the 6th District in Massachusetts to talk about fraud in Katrina funds, maybe a little Iraq funds. The cut-and-run Republicans who will cut and run before the job is done with our tax money. With our money. Doing half-baked jobs. Privatizing, funneling the money through it. The government's just a money laundering front for the Republican Party's cronies. Talk about cut and run. We want our money back. Brad Friedman from Brad Blog will be here to talk about San Diego, the Busby Bill Bray election, where some people took home voting machines and slept with them for days, maybe weeks. Who knows what kind of dirty stuff they did to those machines?
Show me where you touched the voting machine.
That's right. And what it did to that voting machine. Man. And then on top of everything else, Charlie, the guy who, our very creative and talented booker, Charlie, hips me to this thing that was on Oberman last night. Did you watch Oberman?
Not last night, no.
Well, apparently this guy, he brought up this list of, by this guy, John J. Miller, who's the National Review political reporter, talks about 50 greatest conservative rock songs. They are trying to appropriate our stuff. All right, what they do is they think they can just take things. They're revisionist bastards. It's like the guy that tried to appropriate South Park, they try to appropriate the stuff. Now I'm not going to get into a South Park discussion, but he talks about, look at what he has on here. Listen to this, "Taxman" by the Beatles. All right, a George Harrison masterpiece with a famous guitar riff. If you drive my car, I'll tax the street. If you try to sit, I'll tax your seat. If you get too cold, I'll tax you. Blah, 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 blah. The song closes with a humorous jab at death taxes. Now my advice for those who died, declare the pennies on your eyes. So this guy frames it, you know, as some sort of conservative anthem. He did that with Sympathy for the Devil. He tries to find ways to spin lyrics into representing conservative ideology. And believe me, none of these guys, Gloria by U2. Just because a rock song is about faith doesn't mean that it's conservative, but what about a rock song that's about faith and whose chorus is in Latin? That's beautifully reactionary. What are you talking about? Bono had no intention of that. This is revisionism. This is what these guys do. Because out of lack of any new ideas, and because most artists, the reason that they're creative and interesting is by virtue of the fact that they are open-minded, which is anything other than what this guy John J. Miller is. They just steal, appropriate, and redefine and recontextualize what people have done before them and present it as their own. They're like Holocaust deniers. That's what this guy is.
We should take, you know, things like Cat Scratch Fever and, and turn it into a
liberal song.
A liberal song, yeah. I don't know how the hell we do that, because what does it mean anyway? What is wrong with Ted Nugent?
There's a lot of things wrong with Ted Nugent. But
he's hilarious, though.
Yeah, that song is.
But you know, see, what can we take? We don't have anything we can take that these people
you
did.
Mean, wait, rephrase it. There's nothing that we want. Isn't that what you're saying?
Well, I guess not.
There's nothing that I really want.
Music-wise, what the hell did they ever do?
Barack Obama has decided that the Democrats have to reach out to evangelical Christians.
Oh,
this is
man,
a big move to the middle for Barack. You know, he doesn't do much, and then he does this.
He starts off big and then he sells out.
Quote, acknowledge the power that Democrats have acknowledged the power of faith in the lives of the American people. He says, quote, not every mention of God in public is a breach to the wall of separation. Context matters. He says, quote, it is doubtful that children reciting the Pledge of Allegiance feel oppressed or brainwashed as a consequence of muttering the phrase under God. Having voluntary student prayer groups using school property to meet should not be a threat any more than it's to use by the high school Republicans should threaten Democrats, end quote. That's crazy.
It shouldn't be a threat,
but crazy.
It is. You know?
It is a threat.
In reality, it is.
And this is the great white hope here, the great black hope here.
But
this is the triangulating moderate point of view.
So we got to reach out to evangelicals
we got to reach
Robertson.
Out to lunatics. I mean, evangelical Christians who aren't lunatics, which there are some, I've heard from them, but not many. There are Christians that believe in Christian values that are Christ-like and not those of evangelicals or right-wing fanatic Christo-fascist zombies, but this is the triangulation. It's a moderate stance, and it's disappointing that he has to bring this into it. Has to politicize this type of thing.
The definition of being an evangelist is
combat. You will pay,
yeah,
unless you come with me.
It's threatening and combat. It's combative, and
we got some funny people who are iconoclastic and not afraid to take a shot at the Savior, as they have in their past coming up here, but not particularly in this movie. Yeah, maybe a little bit in this movie. I did see the movie Strangers with Candy. If you're a fan of Strangers with Candy, the TV show on Comedy Central, you'll definitely be a fan of the film because it is the beginning of that story of Jerry Blank. And we have Amy Sedaris, the co-writer and star, and Paul Dinello, also a co-writer and star. Stephen Colbert, also co-writer and star, but he's not going to be with us. Just Amy Sedaris, John, and Paul Dinello up next. Stay with us.
And now back to the Mark Maron Show, a Tandy company.
Thank you, Jim. The Comedy Central show, Strangers with Candy, has a very loyal and large following, I believe. Those of you who don't know about it or feel out of the loop will get a chance to start over with the rest of the country when the film Strangers with Candy is released today in New York and L.A., soon to be released across this great nation of ours. The film stars Amy Sedaris and Paul Dinello. They both also co-wrote the film with Stephen Colbert. And I know that Amy Sedaris is on the phone with us now, and there's the outside chance that Paul Dinello will actually get on the phone in the middle of the interview. Is that? And they are talking to us from their hotel room that is so nice, it's got two phones.
Right.
Wow, Amy, luxury. Where are you staying?
We're staying at the Meridian. Perfect timing. Dinello just walked in the door.
He did, so tell him to go.
I'm on the phone. He didn't blow you off. That was so well said. Did you read that off a cue card?
No, it's improvised. I read it. I wrote it down in my brain. Hey, so did you? No, wait. Tell me the truth. Did Paul have to go in the bathroom to get on the other phone?
No, he's right. He's sitting right next to me.
But if I wanted to, I could. I could move my balls and complete our conversation. I'm just saying
it's
that's
a late
kind of
night
hotel.
Show. That's morning behavior.
So,
right.
So they have three phones in the room. That's a nice room.
Yeah.
Did you guys just get here?
We got here yesterday.
Oh.
And I've never done this thing. I've never done a press junket before, so this is all very new to me. And I call all my friends who are real actors, and they're like, this is what you do for a living?
Yeah.
My God.
Did you do the ones where you sit in a booth and you do like 20 radio stations in a row?
Yeah, it's insane.
Isn't that weird? And a voice comes over your head and says, you're on with Joey and the Monkey in Atlanta.
Yeah. Yeah, such some TV show ideas. You're like, what? Yeah, it's been kind of weird. It's been interesting just because it's new.
So I'd known you guys a long time. We used to be in the same hallway at HBO Downtown when you guys...
That's right, we were.
When you did Exit 57, the sketch show that I'm sure still has some serious fans.
Yeah, uh-huh.
And
my parents.
Yeah, and I was doing I was doing short attention span theater and not happy.
And not happy, but you were playing your guitar.
Yeah, I played my guitar a lot, and yeah. I slept on my desk while you guys feverishly wrote...
Isn't that funny? And then Bill Maher down the hall.
I know Bill Maher and
Nipsey Russell hanging up in the hallway. It was weird.
It was weird, and the weird myth of Bill Maher and the towels.
Yeah.
Oh man.
Yes. Finally, someone we can talk to about it.
Yeah. I don't know if anyone knows that about him, but the rumor is that Bill Maher compulsively masturbated before he did any performing.
That's right, into a towel.
And no human could touch his face.
Yeah. Oh, that's a good one too. There goes our chances of ever doing his show. That's okay. No one listens to my show. Look, What I want to know is, because I got to be honest with you, I didn't watch a lot of the series, and I watched the entire movie, and it was enjoyable, it was quirky, and it was funny.
Nice to say thanks.
Thank you,
and,
Mark.
Yeah, and I guess there a couple things came through my mind. First off, if there are people that don't know what the hell I'm talking about, you got to understand, I have a lot of listeners who just sit and blog about politics, and every time I have a conversation like this, they're like, why aren't they talking about important things? So for those people, what would you, like, pitch me the movie. Tell me what it's about in a pitch. You understand what I'm saying, Paul?
Well, it's about a 47-year-old former junkie whore, ex-con, who decides to pick up her life where she left off, which happens to be freshman year in high school. So she goes back to high school and tries to live her life the second time around the right way.
And Amy, you play the character. The character's name is Jerry Blank.
Yes.
And it is such a bizarre, funny character. You don't know really whether she's gay or straight or how fragmented.
She likes the pole in the hole, Mark.
Huh?
She likes the pole in the hole.
Yeah. How did this whole thing come about? You're so funny, and this character is one of those ones where it's like it's disturbing and funny.
Right, that's the best, right?
It is, definitely. She's confused and hostile at the same time.
And poke her with a stick. Well, I think what makes her so funny, too, is because all three of us write for her, so we all bring something different to Jerry, so that's what gives her all those levels. So that's always, and physical humor is always.
And Paul, you play the art teacher. Let me ask you a question. I got a question from my blog, and I owe them because they are really 90% of the audience. Does the name Richard Deutsch mean anything to you?
Richard Deutsch?
Yeah.
I know what Deutsch, but I don't know Richard Deutsch.
Perhaps an art teacher in your past.
Uh-oh, Paul. Do you have a Richard Deutsch? Art? Dick Deutsch?
I was so horrible at art. I've sort of blanked out all the memories.
No, somebody said that she thought that you guys had the same art teacher and that you base this character on him.
Well, I actually had an art teacher named Mr. Jelinek, and then it was some based on that teacher, and then I had another teacher in high school who you'd find out, like, hey, Bill Hines is having a party in his backyard, and you'd show up, and it'd be all kids, drunk kids, and one teacher, and it was this teacher, and he would wear like this
a blouse.
No, he would wear like one of those coats with like those suede jackets with the fringe.
On the
arms and but then like adult shoes.
Yeah.
You know, and sort of adult slack.
Yeah, yeah.
And a nine-inch zipper.
But he would pretend to be like, you know, like, I'm one of you guys.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
hey.
We could talk about stuff. If you smoke pot, it's cool. You know, I'm not gonna. You know, like, he's one of those guys.
Hey,
I don't want to see you out of class.
Yeah, exactly. You want a cigarette? I don't care if you smoke. You want a cigarette?
Right.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I remember those teachers.
No, I shouldn't be doing this.
Yeah, I shouldn't be doing this, but we're cool, you know. Oh, yeah, and you really, the funny thing was the weird bitterness and the kind of, like, you know, I'm going to paint someday thing. Let me ask you a question about where this movie comes from, because I had this moment where I'm watching you and Colbert, and I'm watching Amy, and yeah, great cast, we'll talk about that in a second, but there was actually moments where I'm like, this has, like, jokes, like, I hope you don't take this as an insult, but was the airplane movies any inspiration to you? Did you take that as an insult?
I love airplane movies. I love all those movies.
Well, I guess the only, the one thing we might have taken is the amount of, you know, like the amount of jokes in
an airplane
movie.
Yeah, the side gags.
We try to shove as many in.
Yeah, that's good.
That's good.
Yeah, jokes are good.
I hope something will stick.
Yeah, yeah, because, you know, all of a sudden it's like, hey, we're in a sauna. How the hell did that happen? Why is there a beaded curtain there? Hey, what is that guy doing over there? It's good. It's eye candy. So here's the other question. You've got the Thayer sisters. You've got Dan Hedaya. You got Sarah Jessica Parker, Matthew Broderick, Philip Seymour Hoffman, Allison Janney. I mean, what? How the hell did you get all these people to do the movie? Ian Holmes in the movie.
I know. We have a knight.
A knight.
We have a knight in our movie.
And a couple Emmy winners.
Lot of them. Well, we knew a lot of them. And then Paul Dinello wrote Sir Ian Holmes a letter.
And, you wrote him a letter?
Wrote a script to Dan Hedaya and Alice and Janney. So, I mean, we were just, yeah, I mean, it was, we were so lucky, and everyone was like, yes, immediately.
Well, no, wait, you wrote, what did you say in your letter to Ian?
That's what
to
I
want to
know, when Paul told me the night a letter. I'm like, oh, my God.
Well, I complimented him on Big Night, and,
yeah.
It was full of a lot of compliments.
Yeah.
And then I sort of snuck it in, what would you think about doing our movie? But he would have never done it, but he has a 19-year-old son, and he called his 19-year-old son and said, I got this script.
Do you know these people?
Yeah, do you know these people? And he said, do it, Dad.
Oh,
that's great.
That's so nice.
That's the reason he did
and
it.
And he was great. He was like a real actor. He did each take differently.
Yeah,
I mean, it was like you're supposed to do. So being on the set with all these, you know, Oscar winners and Emmy winners, you're like, oh,
yeah,
okay.
And you've got your pants stuffed with things.
I know, like bits, like sight gags. I'm like, oh, you know.
No,
like,
come on, you know that you're great.
Well, no, we're more like clowns.
Yeah, but you're so much more funnier than anybody else in the movie.
Oh,
I mean, except for Paul and Steve and anyone else who's on the phone, or maybe friends of mine. But so Colbert is big and famous now.
Who? Yeah, I know. Isn't that great?
We don't follow his career. What's happening? I didn't know he was working.
Apparently, he's got a show, and he's somehow affiliated with that Stewart fella.
Oh, I was unaware.
Yeah.
Stewart fella.
Yeah, and he mocked the president to his face in public.
Yeah, he did do that.
Yeah, brilliantly. Did you talk to him about that? Did you see him right after that? Did he look like oh, my God, I did it?
I talked to him a moment. Well, I helped him with that speech.
Yeah.
But most of the credit is his. And,
yeah.
So we went over it, like the night before he did it, and we were convinced that both Bush and the room would laugh.
were you there?
No, I watched it on, it was on like C-SPAN 2 or something.
Because I thought he got pretty good laughs.
Not compared to what that Bush impersonator got.
Bush impersonator.
Yeah, but you know,
had I known, I would have gotten to the Bush impersonating business years ago.
Come on, that guy was a monkey.
That guy was a bit of a monkey.
Yeah, let's talk for a few more minutes. We're going to take a break. Our guests are Amy Sedaris and Paul Dinello. The film is Strangers with Candy. It's the film version. It opens tonight in New York and L.A., and then we'll be playing around the world in a matter of weeks. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Where's the blue food?
Mark Maron.
Thank you, Jim. On the phone, Amy Sedaris and Paul Dinello. Amy Sedaris, of course, the member of the Talent Family. Isn't that what you're called?
Yes, David and I call ourselves the Talent Family.
Her brother, why am I spacing your brother's name? David Sedaris. Yeah?
Yes.
And your other brother, who you guys like to talk about, the Rooster.
My brother Paul talks like, hey, how's it going, Paul? Sounds like Russ Perot.
You call him the Rooster, right?
The Rooster.
Oh, you guys are funny. All right, and Paul Dinello, who has written the movie, they've both written the movie with Stephen Colbert. Dinello, you're working on Colbert's show, right, in some capacity?
Yeah, I call myself a creative consultant.
He's basically Stephen Colbert's friend who Colbert is doing a favor.
That's the only way I get work.
But this is really your baby, this movie, Strangers with Candy. I mean, you're the one that pushed this through for the most part. I remember you were working on this a couple of years ago when I ran into you on the street in New York, and you were selling things or something sad.
I was selling fruit at the corner. And I got threatened by a Dominican, some guy from the Dominican Republic, saying that I was taking business away from him.
Yeah, so you better write that movie.
Yeah, so that motivated me.
But there's a demand for this because I know that the TV show has one of those kind of followings. It's very passionate and very dedicated. You guys must get filter a lot of peculiar fan mail.
Yeah, they're outcast and misfits, ugly people, Mark.
Yes, I know. I get them too.
Yeah, they yeah. And which is a great audience. And you know Comedy Central, they never really got behind, they never get behind anything. So to be a fan of that show, you had to discover it on your own. So I always like people who are, you find things.
Yeah, yeah. And the great thing about those kind of fans is that they're so passionate and loyal that if you're not really careful, they'll find a reason to hate you on a very personal level.
They'll turn on you.
Yeah, fast.
I've done it.
Yeah, those are the kind. Yeah, if they feel betrayed, like if you change a character or something, they'll sneak into your house and light your bed on fire.
Oh yeah,
that's
yeah.
That's the downside with those kind of fans. But other than that, they're completely supportive.
Yeah, the advice I always give about stalkers is that if you have one, you should always take them out to lunch because you will disappoint them. You will be nothing what they thought you were.
I date him in that case.
Exactly. Then
yeah,
they will go away.
No problem.
So this started, the movie and the TV show just started as a sketch? Was it just a sketch?
No, we pitched it to Comedy Central as a TV show.
Oh, okay.
By the way, it opens in New York today. It actually opens in L.A. next week.
Oh, great. Now we got to do the whole thing over.
Yeah, you got to erase all that tape.
Oh, damn it. And I thought it went so well.
No.
Damn it.
No, it didn't.
Right, there's radio.
Oh, man. I'm sorry. Let me get back into it. Hey, so what's going on with you and Letterman, Amy?
Adam Kissintel.
Come on.
Nothing. There's nothing going on.
I know.
Between Letterman and I.
But he produced this film, eh?
Yes, he did, actually.
He's a huge...
It says a lot about him, you know, that he would give us $3 million to do a movie for this audience. Because everything's for pretty people, you know? So it says so much about him.
But David's one of the ugly people. He's one of us.
It says he doesn't have much business acumen, is what it says.
But did you guys have to meet with him and talk about this thing?
No, we went through Rob Burnett, Worldwide Pants, the guy who runs that. But we got notes from David, and he was, you know, watched it a lot, and he was involved.
Uh-huh.
But we didn't have to sit down across from a table and look at each other.
Oh, that's good. But when you're on his show, he's so thrilled that you're there. I think you entertain him.
Well, I think because I never have anything to promote. So when he calls me, I'm literally, my hair is wet, you know what I mean? So when he says, thanks for dropping by, he's not lying, you know?
Yeah.
It's one of those things. So I love doing his show.
Yeah, it's very funny.
Yeah.
All right, so are you doing anything other than the movie?
I have a book coming out in October, a cookbook, and Paul Dinello helped me write it.
You guys wrote a cookbook, too?
He helped me write it. I was trying to take it seriously, and then Paul read it and was like, mocking it. So now it's more entertaining than...
Is Colbert involved in any way?
No, I have a shrimp paste recipe in it.
A shrimp paste?
Yes,
like a
really
Thai?
He considers himself
his notorious shrimp paste recipe.
Yeah.
Now, wait, when someone like you writes a cookbook, because you know, I like to cook, but I cook like four things. Now, are you a big cook, or did you just like look at weird recipes and say, I'm going to put this in it?
No. It's all my jackpot recipes.
Really?
Well, it's more of a general entertaining book.
Oh really?
It's
not a.
It expands. It's more expansive than just cooking.
Now, Paul, would that be the section of the bookstore it's in? General entertainment, or
entertainment?
I think it's going to be under. I think it's going to be categorized as insane scrapbook.
Yeah, it is more of an art book. It's for the illiterate. It's very lots of pictures.
Now it's an art book. It went from general
entertainment. Well, it's a hospitality book.
It's whatever you would like it to be.
Crafts and recipes.
Are we talking a coffee table? Book?
Well, no, you still can. You need to follow the recipes. It belongs in the kitchen or den, you know, in your den.
All right.
Or rec room. It'd be
fan.
A good rec room book.
So are you going to hang out with, who do you hang out with when you're out here, you guys? Like, what happens now? You're gonna talk to me, and then you're going to take the rest of the day off because
then
you...
We're heading over to Jeff Goldblum's house. We're going to play some ball.
Oh, okay. So you can go to Jeff Goldblum's, play a little ball. And are you going to hang out with Richter, the Richters?
No, we're not here long enough. We're taking the red eye home tonight.
Why?
We're going to go do Craig Ferguson, and then we're going to leave after that.
Craig Ferguson, he's a manic, strange person.
Well, again, everyone I know who's been on his show, just they love it.
They say it's a good time?
Yeah, good times. I'm excited about doing it. Paul did it last night, and it's on Friday night. He did a really great job.
You were on the show there, Paul?
Yes, I was.
And then they showed clips of the movie?
They did indeed.
And you said some funny things?
Yeah, he did.
I attempted
funny.
To.
And you let Craig ramble on in his Scottish manner?
Yeah. Haggis Manor.
And yeah. It's Rogue.
Yeah. All right. Well, have a great time, and thanks for coming on my show.
Oh, sure, Mark.
Thanks, Mark. And really nice talking to you.
It was nice talking to you, and hopefully I'll see you guys when I come to New York at some place or somewhere. Maybe I'll come do the Colbert Show. Just tell him I'm going to come do it.
Oh, he would love it.
Okay.
Yeah, just surprise him, and we'll let him know that you're the guest moments before you're the guest.
All right, I'm going to hold you that. I got it on tape. See you later, you guys.
Thanks,
all right,
Mark,
man, bye.
Bye. The movie is Strangers with Candy. That was Amy Sedaris and Paul Dinello. It opens tonight in New York, for those of you listening in New York. And I think he said, what, tomorrow? Next week here in L.A.? And then everywhere. Theaters everywhere. We'll be back with John Amato.
Yeah, that's the New York Times. It says we're not being unpatriotic. We're just doing our role.
What?
In the this is what it says. In free press is an essential place in the Constitution because it can provide information to the public, needs to make things right again. Even if it
what
runs
are you right again?
Being labeled
hey,
unpatriotic.
We want to be safe. We want to be safe.
Spin.
They just made it more difficult for the government to do the job that they're supposed to. The number one job. Keep us alive.
We
number
will.
One, you can't pay your taxes, you can't do anything else if you're dead.
That's right.
Hey, folks, as you know, the website crooksandliars.com is a clearinghouse of video and news clips that call the right out on their crap. Thank God it exists. I don't know where everyone gets the time to do all this stuff, but John Amato is over there, a first-class media gnome, sports fan, music freak, former member of Duran Duran, kinda. He's here with us again. Thanks for coming down, John Amato from Crooks and Liars.
Hey, buddy, how are you?
I'm good, man. So we just came in with that clip of E.D. Hill freaking out on Fox News. I mean, it's amazing that they are defending this attack on the New York Times for doing their job, and she is literally just saying, "Hey, isn't the Constitution worth sacrificing if you're afraid?"
I mean, it's like they don't, you know. It's all these talking points, and this just illustrates how out of Karl Rove's mouth comes Fox News. And they beat this drum on the New York Times, and Ron Suskind the other day just said that, like, the terrorists knew about this 3 years ago. People got arrested. It wasn't even worth, you know, it wasn't catching anybody. And it's nuts. And the question I'm asking and Frumkin's asking is, you know what? Show us some proof where these stories have hurt national security.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And for anyone to assume that the terrorists don't know or maybe possible terrorists don't know that they're being investigated on that level is ridiculous. I mean, it's the first thing anyone would do. But to hide it from the American people, I mean, what the hell do they have to lose by saying, you know, we're being transparent about what they're trying to do and going about it in a legal way? It's not going to deter from the effectiveness of it.
I mean, they've been doing it for years. It's nobody's saying it's illegal. It's a story, and you notice that you know, they needed a new whipping boy, obviously. And you notice that the Wall Street Journal, the LA Times, they've printed it. You don't hear anybody going after them. And I know there's going to be a story breaking, you know, where the administration gave the Wall Street Journal and gave the LA Times information for their article. So it's okay to do that, and then they use the New York Times as whipping boys. It's really ridiculous. It's the age-old attack the media, blame the media. The Iraq's a mess because of the media, and this is, you know, they're just really going off the deep end on this.
But it's interesting how what you're saying is true, is that, and you can see it really well on your site on Crooks and Liars because of and also, you know, posting that the Jim Wolcott thing from his blog is great because he's a sharp guy, and just to see that this is a major talking points movement against the New York Times, which, as you said, has been a right wing whipping boy forever, but for reasons of liberal bias. And now what they're doing is they're sort of widening that and saying not only are they liberal in their bias, but they have compromised, you know, national security, and they are anti-American. It adds to the frame, and all of this stuff, the flag amendment thing, all this stuff is just heading towards these midterm elections, and they're doing it around the 4th of July, and they're making it all, you know, come together in one big jingoistic package.
Yeah, it's really, you know, they really have no scruples. It
you know, watching Peter King, I mean, I'm in, you know, a New Yorker. I mean, I live in L.A. now, but, I'm a New Yorker. And watching a guy like him, it's really embarrassing being a New Yorker listening to this guy talk. And
what a kiss-ass bully.
I mean, you know, we're talking about newspapers. We're talking about reporting. This is their job. They're not hurting anybody. And it's all, you know, let's go after the Times. We can change the theme. It's, oh, poor President Bush, everything he does.
Yeah.
You know, like Bill O'Reilly the other night was saying that now, I should have put that up. I haven't had a chance. No foreign country will work with us now because, hey, we work with them, and then it's in the New York Times. I mean, it's completely ridiculous.
Yeah, and what's really ridiculous is that if anybody believes that the press shouldn't be reporting this kind of stuff, they really believe in something that isn't democracy. They really believe in something that is fundamentally anti-American in structure. And they for some reason, they can't make that turn in their head that whatever these guys are trying to do in terms of covert operations around information is they're trying to divert and go around Congress. They're trying to consolidate all of the power into the executive branch and deny our form of government. And I don't understand why the hell Democrats or people like you and me can't spin this the other way and make people realize that these people are behaving in an anti-American fashion.
You know, like a big part of the problem is our media itself. The media is under siege by this administration, yet all you see, you know, the supposed liberal CNN is, as the New York Times traitors, and they feed into the meme. You know, it's like the talking points get down. I know they need content, but then they just blow it up, and then they have these nuts like Peter King on and allow them to speak for 10 minutes. Then they'll have on an unbiased Q Hewitt, just sprouting off constantly with a weak-kneed liberal who doesn't even know the issue. It's no wonder that this stuff is splashed everywhere.
That idiot Glenn Beck on his radio show compared them, reporting on the story to them saying during Nazi Germany, the ovens aren't that bad. You know, they kill Jews, but they could, they can make pizza in there too.
Yeah.
And I'm paraphrasing, but what the hell does that even mean? Why are these people allowed to talk? Well, they're allowed to talk because the same amendment that they're trying to disregard enables them that freedom.
Right, they're allowed to do that, but yet on any news, any news that's negative to this administration, they've been working on this for 20 years. I mean, when Reagan, got rid of the fairness doctrine,
yeah,
this is what we got, and we're stuck with it. And even with good old Rush Limbaugh getting busted, getting caught with his Viagra pills, there you got Bill O'Reilly saying that the state of Florida is just out to get him. The guy was searched. He's known to be a drug guy, and they're going to look at his stuff. And what is he doing carrying prescriptions that doesn't have his name on it?
Yeah, well, that's a question. With that, it's weird. I had a weird moment, John. I was listening to the guy who's filling in for Sam and Janine last night going off on Rush and making character judgments around the Viagra, and which is funny. It's all a big joke. But he was really making certain insinuations, like, which is fine. But the real crime is, why has this guy got pills that aren't in his name? I mean, and it's fine to, assassinate his character around Viagra, but it is an OxyContin. It's just Viagra. You know, it's not like it's heroin, for Christ's sake. It's a joke. But the real crime is, what the hell is he doing with it? And is there any way they could stick it to him?
Right, I did some reporting yesterday, and I called, I called the California Medical Board, and they said that, first of all, I'm hearing it's a federal crime, but, they all said that doctors don't write scripts in somebody else's name, even their name, even high-profile people, and then give it to somebody else. I talked to Beverly Hills addiction specialists who deal with high-profile actors. They don't do that. I called the Florida Medical Board. They wanted me to give them the name of the doctor who did it. That in itself, I know something about doctors because of my medical condition.
Yeah.
And I know the great pains that they go to when they write scripts, that everything's above board. There is no hanky-panky. And this is just, you can't, I saw the Edmondson is his name, who's I think the attorney's office, said, well, you know, if he just made a quick remark, he doesn't seem like he even knows the laws of Florida. And I'm not making fun. A lot of people are making fun of the whole Viagra thing. Hey,
it's
you know,
funny.
A lot of guys take it. That's that. But I've been all over the doctors because a guy who gets addicted to pain meds, like Rush Limbaugh, had help. And the doctors, there are great doctors out there, and you know, and I have some great ones, and I have a lot of respect for them. And then there are some jerks, and there are enablers. And if he wasn't doctor shopping, then whoever was his doctor should lose his medical license, because you don't become addicted to OxyContin through prescriptions without help.
No, that's absolutely right. And I think this doctor probably broke the law. And I think that, yeah, I don't have any real big problem with you know, character assassinating Rush Limbaugh. Who cares? You know, I mean, he was probably down there having sex with hookers and doing whatever it is that an OxyContin addict does with Viagra. Yeah, I have no problem with making jokes about that and everything else. But, I mean, the real issue is, I just wish to hell that somehow or another this could stick to him and compromise his parole and really put him in the pokey there.
Well, you know, I'm calling tomorrow because I had also called the police station.
Yeah.
And they told me that, well, the attorney's office hasn't gotten the quote unquote packet yet of information, and they won't really comment on it until they look at the evidence. And, you know, I talked to the spokesman for the police department, Mr. Miller, I believe. And, you know, and I just explained to him, and the guy knows what's going on. And he said, look, we're looking at this.
Yeah.
So who knows?
All right. I mean,
it'll be tough. You know, he's got his friends. But, you know, if it's you or me having a script like that, the Florida Medical Board was like telling me that is unethical and illegal. Now, there may be some law somewhere that I couldn't find on their websites, and when I talked to them, the fact that a doctor writing a prescription. Now, I know if there's a, you know, let's say you have a grandmother or a grandfather who can't, you know, who's old and can't do things, and I can see a doctor, like, putting a script in, like, their son's name for that type of thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like a circumstance like that might be fine, but to do a script for Viagra doesn't fall into that same parameter.
Not unless he was nodding out on OxyContin and he was worried that, I don't even know how that plays into it, but maybe he saw him as an invalid.
Someone said, you know, they're the same color pills as OxyContin. And it's like, you know, I'm not going down that route because I'm really interested in the other, like, the whole prescription.
Yeah,
thing.
Well, we'll see what happens. And thanks for pointing out, we got to go here, but thanks for pointing out that Michelle Malkin supporting Joe Lieberman for Senate, because it really made me realize something, that's who he's going after. He's relying on Republicans to vote him back into the Senate in Connecticut.
That's why he's going to have to run eventually as an independent, because he can't get Democratic support.
All right. Thanks a lot, John Amato. Great talking to you, as always.
Talk to you later.
All right, buddy. Take care. John Amato, crooksandliars.com, doing the big research into the Rush Limbaugh weenie lifters issue. We'll be back in a minute.
And now he's not the one that he wants, Mark Maron.
Thank you, Jim. A lot of disturbing news coming out of New Orleans around FEMA. The fact about that FEMA, that since it has been moved into the Department of Homeland Security, it has lost its ability to respond effectively to emergencies, both on a financial level and on the level of resource. It has been gutted and sold out to private companies that frequently get no-bid contracts to do work the government was once able to oversee and guarantee to some degree. Well, now the chickens are coming home to roost a bit, if I can use that one. There's billions of dollars worth of fraud, and the disaster of our time really became a money laundering front for Bush administration cronies, not unlike Iraq, and something needs to be done about it. U.S. Representatives John Tierney from Massachusetts and Jim Leach from Iowa are calling for the establishment of a Truman Committee, which will help restore accountability and get some oversight into this problem. Finally, Congressman Tierney joins us on the phone. Welcome to the show, Congressman.
Thanks very much, Mark.
Well, you know, there have been a lot of reports on scams on behalf of people and organizations that tried to rip the government off in the wake of Katrina one way or another, and FEMA oversight in the distribution of funds was shoddy. But is the reason for that because FEMA has been so underfunded and undercut since it was taken out of its own cabinet position?
I believe so, Mark. I think what happened was you got a bunch of people who really don't believe in government responding to people's needs, and what they did was basically outsourced FEMA.
Yeah.
First, they put it in the Homeland Security, which I thought was a mistake, with 22 other agencies, and sort of obfuscated whose responsibility it was.
Yeah.
And they sort of, you know, then devolved, I think is a favorite word they did. They wanted to push all the responsibilities onto the states and local communities, with FEMA just sort of there, you know, to outsource the work and to sort of give a broad overview. But even then, it was confusion on when they saw something wrong, where were they supposed to go, laterally or, you know, vertically, or where were they going to go? And it just became a fiasco.
Well, at the very least, I was reading this article today, Congressman. It was just very disturbing that because of this gutting of FEMA, that apparently they stopped since 1998. They don't even do drills anymore, statewide or state-specific drills, emergency drills, and that the charge, the money that was put aside to sponsor those exercises went from $2 million to $196,000. So they don't even have any training or any community awareness, and they're just relying on these subcontractors to do damage control, whereas there's no preventative medicine going on.
Well, you know, when James Lee Witt was the head of FEMA from 93 to about 2000, and it was the premier federal agency in the country. It had not been that good before 93. He made it into a great agency, responsive. Even George Bush, when he was governor of Texas, said it was the best federal agency he ever dealt with, because they did preventative things and mitigation things. They didn't let the same problem arise a second time. They got things placed out in advance, right off wherever they thought the storm was going to be. They had centers where they had supplies and planes at the ready to go. They had already negotiated the contract, so they got the lowest price, and people just had to respond. All of that was set aside, and nothing was put in to replace it, and all the confusion set in. So at the last minute, as the disaster was hitting or had struck, you find an agency scrambling around trying to figure, is it the state's issue, or is it the local community's issue, or is it FEMA's issue, or the Army's issue? Who's responsible to negotiate for trailers, to get food in here, to get water in here, to get people housed? And it was just a mess.
And you know what scares me is I just the more I read about the fraud that was done on behalf of some local government officials down there, and also on some companies down there, and just all the money that was wasted and funneled out. And now I'm reading stuff about how they're not going to rebuild a lot of public housing, and that there's actually some support within the government of New Orleans and Louisiana to disenfranchise about 5,000 mostly black poor people.
Well, you know, we Jim Leach and I saw this at the outset. We had actually filed a similar bill to this about the Afghanistan situation, and we put it on the Truman bill during World War II. So we thought all those contracts had to be monitored. Congress legislates, and then it should have oversight. You know, follow the money, make sure the troops are getting what they need to get to keep them alive, and make sure the money is being spent appropriately. On this situation, when we saw it arising, we filed a similar bill and said, look, you know, we legislate, but the second thing is follow the money, make sure the people that are the victims down there don't get disenfranchised, make sure that it goes there and that the taxpayers know their money is being well spent. And just, it's been like pulling teeth to try and get people to get on board here.
Well, that's the horrible thing, is that because of the Republican-dominated House, that these guys, they seem to have lost their conscience. And not that they ever had one, but they seem that they all just get on board, despite the fact that there's, you know, literally millions and billions of dollars of taxpayers' money being funneled into the hands of administration cronies. And there are people on the street and incapable to readjust to their lives.
Well, you know, a lot of my Republican colleagues in the rank and file will tell me to my face, well, this is a great idea, but the leadership won't let us get on the bill. And we can't get this thing through the Rules Committee. You know, we get it to the floor of the House on a rare occasion, like in the supplemental spending bills for the storm damage, and then they say it's out of order and we have a vote and they vote it down. But most of the time we try to get it on some bill as a vehicle to get it to the floor, and the Rules Committee, there's 9 Republicans and 4 Democrats, on a 9-4 vote, say, no, we're not even going to let our members vote. And they just have they are afraid that it's going to be too critical, that it's going to look like a blight on their record. Well, This isn't about criticizing anybody. This is about getting people the relief they're supposed to get, saving lives, and following the money, making sure the taxpayers' money isn't just going down a sinkhole somewhere.
I'll tell you, you know, I don't want to politicize it, but I, you know, it seems to me that it's almost a racist and bordering on classist policy that just once again shows the people with no money in this country, the victims of this situation, that their government doesn't care about them, and I don't understand why we can't make a point as Democrats to say this is how Republicans cut and run.
Well, I think you're right on that. Only on this part of it, I think it's their ideology.
Uh-huh.
You know, I think their ideology is that they don't want government to do this type of thing. They would like to leave this issue to the local city or town or to the state and say that the federal government only does the military, have a good day on everything else. That's their ideology.
Yeah,
their ideology is the smallest federal government. What did Norquist say? Put it in a bathtub so you could drown it. And when you say that, it means that you don't expect your government to come in and give the most basic relief to citizens that we've always had in this country as a shared responsibility, as a matter of fairness, so that people could rely on making sure that their lives had, you know, some meaning and some protection.
But
they don't believe in that.
I understand that, and I understand what you're saying, but it seems to me that this privatization idea of what was once government responsibility, you know, whatever criticisms you might have had anyone might have had about how the government handles things or how a government bureaucracy works, is that it was there and it was guaranteed by the government. And when you have this privatization scheme, it just seems to me that 9 times out of 10, they're going to go to ex-government operatives or cronies or people who have paid for these politicians. And most of the time, the greed is going to enter the picture. The job is half done or shoddily done or not done at all. And then the people get at the bottom get the shaft.
Yeah, well, look, there are some things that government just should do. I mean, whenever you have a relief, an emergency relief situation, you expect that you might have a couple of percent, 1%, 2% of money that leaks out somewhere that you just can't keep all your fingers on it. But this is bordering on 20, 25, and 30% of the money being gone off to graft and corruption and mismanagement or whatever. That's private industry. These are people who have outsourced it to. So when I say they wish government ran like a private business, that's baloney. What, like Enron, like, you know, the airlines that are
right.
Going under? You know, the case is sometimes government does the most efficient job, and they're held accountable by the taxpayer, and that's why they should be overseeing it. That's why taxpayers should be upset. You might not be able to oversee a private corporation, but you sure as heck can oversee your government. If they're not doing the job, you should be fighting mad about it.
Yeah, our guest is Congressman John Tierney from Massachusetts 6th District, and we're talking about this mismanagement of funds. Now, what are we looking at now? We're looking at about $2 billion in fraud for Katrina.
Well, that's just this latest report in the New York Times. That, you know, like, there's more than meets the eye on a range of other things there, and that's why the committee should be digging into this thing.
And what
those are the blatant ones. I mean, you know, it was a $10 million in rental and disaster relief assistance that went to 1,100 prison inmates.
Yeah, that was crazy.
I mean, come on, that would have been, with any degree of oversight, that would have been disclosed. I mean, we've got trailers sitting in Arkansas that can't even be used, and somebody was getting a cost-plus basis contract on just getting them from one point to another.
And somebody's making $250,000 to store them
exactly,
a month.
Exactly, and it's just... It gets nutty, and that's what makes people should understand there was no effective oversight going here. And I know the Republicans say, well, the standing committees, you know, are there to have oversight. Well, they ain't doing it.
Well,
and that's why you need this special committee to do it, because it is not being done by the standing committees. Streamline it. Don't create another level of bureaucracy. Streamline it. Instead of having 3 or 4 or 5 committees doing different aspects, get one committee, have them become experts on this, get the inspector generals who have done some of this digging that gave the basis for that New York Times report, get them in to testify, get their staffs working on this, and get it done. Bring this back into boundaries here.
Isn't it fascinating that this government says they don't like government, but all they do in order to obfuscate or slow things down is create more government?
Well, you know, that's why I say this is streamlining it into a single committee, you know, in a house that already exists, just focus it on the job. But they like government if they can outsource it and spend a lot of money on it, if they can give people in private business a lot of money to do what government used to do for less.
Yeah. Now, what are we looking at? If let's say, you know, hopefully that the House shifts and we get the Democratic majority in there, this would be a top priority, right?
Accountability is one of the first three things that ought to be done the first day we're in.
Okay.
You know, one is transparency on the way this place runs down here. Put democracy back in the House. One of my friends says, you know, democracy is, the Rules Committee is where democracy goes to die the way they do it now. No amendments, no discussion, no debate.
Wow.
But the other thing is, you know, accountability. That's our responsibility. We legislate and we have oversight. Put oversight back. And we've got excellent people. Henry Waxman,
great.
John Dingell. They've made reputations, whether it was a Democrat or a Republican president. They did great oversight and they did hundreds of more hearings than have been done since 2001 when this administration and this Republican majority got in.
Well, Congressman John Tierney, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
You take care.
See you, Mark.
Bye-bye. Man, I hope to hell that, you know, we can somehow... accountability, that's the key word. Accountability and cut-and-run Republicans with our money. With our money.
Turn it back on the cut-and-run. You know,
Turn it back on them. I'd like to do that.
Cut-and-run on education, the environment, Bill of Rights, everything
I think it's
else.
A good idea. Yeah?
Okay, I'll go with it.
Right on. We'll be back in a second.
And now he died for your sins, Mark Maron.
Unbelievable. Still reeling, Congressman Tierney, just the inability for the Dems to get any traction around stuff that is just so reasonable, practical, and right. Just right to do for the government to take action. It's shameful. Shameful, Jim. I'll tell you one thing that's good is that this whole values agenda is falling by the wayside. The flag amendment fails, but not by much. We got an email from a very pissed off fan about this.
Mm-hmm.
I'm glad it failed, though I am sad that I burned all my flags yesterday, thinking I wouldn't be able to. This guy, Joe, who's a regular listener, he said, I'm not really relieved that it failed. The amendment. I'm stunned and angered that it could be anywhere near that close. It's like if someone took a shot at me and just missed, I wouldn't be all giddy that I was still alive. I'd be saying, what the? Someone just tried to shoot me. And I'd take that SOB out. Well, someone took a shot at my Constitution yesterday, and I'm not too happy about it. A whole bunch of people, senators actually, sworn to protect and defend the Constitution, not the flag. For us, it's utterly astonishing. And I don't think we get to take the SOBs out. Yet. Additionally disturbing is the proposed amendment itself. It doesn't define legalities, it grants power. Its broad generality leaves interpretation entirely to the Congress and sets no specific limits. It is a formula for abuse of power. The proposed amendment, sponsored by Senator Orrin Hatch, Republican of Utah, reads, quote, the Congress shall have power to prohibit the physical desecration of the flag of the United States, end quote. How much power? What constitutes desecration? How much punishment? Are there any limits? Frightening stuff. That's from a listener who clearly should be writing for me. Joe in Wisconsin. It's Jerogo on the blog. He also said, Land of Feingold. Was he not the strongest and most focused you have ever seen him on Sunday? Brilliant analysis and articulation of crucial issues. We need to fully recognize what we have here in leadership. That's for sure. And this country needs to step up and learn how to elect a Jew for president. You're saying that on behalf of the country? I don't know. Feingold.
Mm.
Feingold's the best. He's the only guy out there that's worthy of the job. But the other thing that they failed to advance a bill in the House protecting the words under God in the Pledge of Allegiance, which is good. Which is good.
You know, there's already other good news, too. A recent Gallup poll said that... less people in America believe that there should be a constitutional amendment protecting the flag in that manner.
Yeah, well, I mean, that means that some people understand the Constitution a bit, you know, as we all should, as I'm starting to, that it's a matter of protecting what the founders had put in place, the government, the system that was supposed to be. If they start chipping away at that thing, man, they wipe their butts with it like these guys do. We're just the
good morning yesterday. You wake up and time has slipped away. And suddenly it's hard to find the memories you left behind. Remember, do you remember
Jim,
life?
Jim, what are you doing?
Mark, Did you know for years the fine people at Kodak have made it possible for us to preserve the cherished moments of our lives in photo albums such as these?
I suppose so.
Yeah, but did you also know that over time even the finest photographic paper can become brittle and turn to dust?
Yeah, I've heard that. I guess that's...
Yeah. That's where urine comes in.
Oh, God.
You know, properly labeled and stored in mason jars, urine can last forever.
Uh-huh. Oh, man.
Ah, here's a good memory. Christmas, 1975.
Oh, dude.
Asparagus.
Yeah.
Ah, here's another favorite of mine. Fear pee.
What?
Yeah. I don't even need to date this one. It's pretty much an ongoing project. You
hey,
know what
hey
I mean.
Jim, I realize things have been pretty stressful lately, and...
Mark, everything's just fine. You know, urine will always be there for you.
Uh-huh.
One thing's for sure, urine will never tell you you have to go into business school and forget about your dreams of becoming a dancer. Urine will never break up with you 2 days before Thanksgiving.
Uh-huh.
Ah, here's another one. 1983. Bar fight.
Oh, Jesus. Why is it red?
Mark, it's labeled bar fight.
Oh.
So if you'd like to share in some of my cherished memories, call or email Air America Radio today and just ask for Jim's urine. That's right, ask for Jim Earl's urine. They'll all know what it's about.
Oh, my God. What is that?
It's a scrotum floating in a jar of saline solution. What the hell does it look like? Don't judge me. I did what I had to do. The laughter and the tears, the shadows of misty yesteryears, the good times and the bad you've seen, and all the others in between. Remember, do you remember the times of your life? Asparagus.
We'll be back with Brad Friedman.
And now he's Naomi Campbell's latest assault victim, Mark Maron.
Dig this, Lou Dobbs. Along with 97% of his viewers, vote to do away with e-voting. That was on a show, I think it was last night, maybe the night before last. Brad Friedman, my friends, is a true activist. He's out there in the world, both on his blog, bradblog.com, and in person, fighting for election reform, fighting to get rid of these machines or correct it. Brad is down in San Diego right now as we speak, preparing for a second emergency town hall meeting, along with around 25 other election integrity groups, to make a no-confidence declaration for the Busby-Bilbray election down there that happened a few weeks ago. He's on the phone with us now to talk about the substance of that declaration. Welcome back to the show, Brad Friedman.
Hey, man. Thank you, brother. Great to be here. Listen, I'm a journalist, not an activist. I guess I've become an activist because the rest of the folks out there aren't doing the damn job they ought to be and fighting for our elections, man.
Activist journalist, that's a fine title to have.
That's it.
That puts you up there with Robert Scheer and any other journalist who speaks truth to power is an activist, unfortunately.
I'm happy to be in the same ring with Robert Scheer anytime.
Okay, man. So let's talk about the specifics of this of the election, about the results, about what's making it questionable, because apparently there was some what would you call it, hanky panky with the voting machines.
Well, what happened Dobbs talked about this, and today, Washington Post, you can see the headline, "A Single Person Can Infect an Entire Election." That's what we're talking about, because what they've done down here in San Diego, it's an entirely Diebold county,
mm-hmm.
and we've recently learned specifically that the Diebold machines, perhaps more than any others, can be hacked incredibly vulnerably in 2 minutes' time, no password necessary. And when this was discovered in just the past couple of months, the California State and the feds put in special emergency mitigation procedures that had to be followed before these things could be used.
Right.
Here we come to this first federal election since these procedures, the Busby-Bilbray election that everyone's calling a bellwether for November. And the registrar down here completely throws out those procedures and sends these voting machines home with poll workers for days and weeks prior to the election, to be stored in cars and garages on these sleepovers. It's incredible.
No one knows what, you know, what they're the Republican or Democrat or who they really are, just took these hackable computerized voting machines home for days and weeks. Who the hell knows what happens? Who knows who could have visited them? Who knows who could have offered them money or actually if they could have done tampering? Who knows?
Exactly right. And, you know, it's like a blood sample. If you took a blood sample at a crime scene and sent it home with a worker to keep in their garage or car for a week, you know, it'd be laughed out of court, would never be allowed in the crime lab. It, you know, it's presumed contaminated. That's what they're doing with our votes here, and that's why all of these groups, California Election Protection and PDA and so forth, have declared no confidence in this race, and they're demanding a manual hand count of the ballots in this California 50 race.
How is that? Is that even possible?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's possible. For example, we could file for a recount.
There are paper trails? There are ballots to be counted?
Yeah. There are optical. It was a blended system, optical scans. So we've got the paper ballots and touchscreen DREs where we have the paper trails. Forget about those. But the op-scan ballots, most of the ballots were paper op-scan ballots. So, yeah, they can be counted.
Okay, so let me just ask you, yeah. Brad Friedman, an op-scan ballot is something you fill out and slide into a machine.
That's what you fill out. You fill in the piece of paper, fill in the bubbles, and then, yeah, it goes through a scan counter, and that's exactly what can be gamed. Up in Iowa, on the same day, June 6th, that we had the election out here in California,
uh-huh.
Two different elections had Republican incumbents losing the elections after the paper ballots were optically scanned. And they were both very popular incumbents, and the election director said something doesn't seem right. They decided to go back, count them by hand, and what do you know, in both cases, the guy who had been declared the loser ended up winning the race on the same day as the election out here in California.
And these were Republicans?
Yeah, it was a Republican primary. One primary, there was 10 candidates in the race, and the incumbent came in 10th after the ballots were optically scanned. And then when they counted them by hand, lo and behold, it turned out he actually won the election.
So what's interesting about that in terms of the partisan nature of myself and my network is that what you're saying is it might not have been intentional. It might have just been some sort of botched screw-up on behalf of the machine.
Well, in fact, we don't exactly know what went wrong with those machines in Iowa, but they are incredibly inaccurate. They are incredibly prone to tampering, and that's why they put in these emergency security procedures, and that's why it's so incredible that Michael Haas, the registrar down there, would simply toss out the emergency procedures and send these machines home on sleepovers.
I just realized I did something. I just realized that in my head, the only thing that could have gone wrong in that race is that the machines could have malfunctioned, not that a Democrat would dare fix the machines, you know.
Well, it could. Who knows?
Yeah,
well,
anybody can. It was a primary.
So yeah. It was actually up in Iowa, it was between a bunch of Republicans.
Oh, so it was all Republicans.
Yeah.
So theoretically, yeah, see, they're bad guys. Someone screwed with the machine.
See, there you go.
All right, I'm glad we brought that around.
But, you know, I mean, that's the point. Look, you never know, and frankly, I'm not even alleging fraud in the Busby-Bilbray race because the point is we don't know, we can't know. And I can tell you this loud and clear, the San Diego County Registrar of Voters cannot prove that his election was counted accurately. It's impossible. It cannot be done unless they count those paper ballots.
Now, okay, so there was a town meeting last night. And there's one that will be you might still be doing it by the time this airs. What's the turnout been? Now, is Marcy Winograd down there with you? You got some progressive Democrats down there as well?
Yeah, we had Marcy was out last night. We did one in L.A. Marcy Winograd, Mimi Kennedy, Jeannie Crescenzo, who's a candidate down here. I'm keynoting and emceeing this event, and some other folks from down here in San Diego. And we've invited, get this, we've invited Roger Hedgecock. Do you know who he is?
The name sounds familiar, but no.
Well, he's familiar because he's not only a San Diego radio host, fills in for Rush Limbaugh.
He's a right-wing guy, right? You had him on your blog the other day.
Yeah, I mean, he makes Rush Limbaugh seem like Cindy Sheehan, basically.
Seemed like someone who's not a drug addict.
Well, exactly.
All right.
So he is so far to the right, and I went on his show recently, was ready for a firefight, and guess what? He's 100% on board. He thinks this is crazy. And he's a Bill Bray supporter, you know, and you mentioned Lou Dobbs, who's been covering this every night, not exactly a lefty moonbat.
Well, you know, you got to assume that the disappointment that these real conservatives feel with this this coup d'etat, this horrendous government that's in place now and what they're willing to do, they've got to save some face somewhere and they've got to stand on some principle. So I assume those guys are out there.
Well, you're cynical, Mark.
I know. I know, but I mean, but I talked to a guy, talked to this guy, Doug McIntyre. He's kind of a right-wing talk show host the other day. And he
kind
of. Yeah, and he can't stand this administration, and he wants this stuff to be transparent and on the table.
Well, I got to give credit to both Dobbs and Hedgecock. Whatever their motivations are, you know, Dobbs has been outspoken against Bush. Hedgecock is much more supportive, I think, of Bush. Either way, they've got the intellectual honesty to stand up and say, look, it doesn't matter who's doing this. If we don't have democracy, we've got nothing, and it could be just as easily a Democrat who games the system as it could be a Republican.
How was the turnout last night?
We had a couple hundred folks. Pretty good. And I hear that, we'll see how it's going to be tonight in San Diego. I'm hearing a lot of noise, and I've been getting phone calls all the way down here from TV stations and everything else. So Lord only knows what we'll get.
Now, what needs to happen now? What in the best case scenario, you do these two town hall meetings, you raise your case, and then what's the best thing that could happen?
Well, the best thing that can happen is probably going to be a legal procedure, and we're trying to figure out exactly the best way to proceed there. There could be some pretty high-profile names coming in on this, making some noise about this, and demanding one way or another, if it's through a recount procedure, if it's through an election contest, we're trying to figure out the best way to do that, to basically, you know, say, look, you ran an illegal election with 100% decertified machines. There ought to be a law against it.
Right.
Turns out there is, but getting holding someone accountable here for the rule of law is not an easy thing.
And if you succeed in this and you make enough noise and you do get that far, it would set some sort of precedent for this stuff.
Well, that's exactly what this is about. Frankly, I don't care who won the Busby Bill Bray race. This is about November and assuring that when we have 435 of these things happening on the same day in November, that we've taken care of this problem in the first place, because I promise you, the election is November 7. If these guys wait around, whether it's the DNC or anybody else, until November 8th, forget about it. I mean, we're having trouble fighting one lousy federal race. They're going to fight 435 of these at the same time, plus 30, you know, Senate races. The time is now to effect any actual election reform.
All right. Well,
prior to November.
Well, that is a dire cry for action. Thank you so much, Brad Friedman, bradblog.com. Go there, get involved. I appreciate your time, man.
Hey, thanks, brother. Send people to velvetrevolution.us to sign the declaration, and we'll move this thing forward.
Velvetrevolution.us. All right, Brad, take it easy.
Thanks, my friend.
Okay, man. Velvetrevolution.us. I'm writing that down. Velvetrevolution.us. You writing it down?
Right now.
Velvet.
How do you spell velvet?
V-E-L-V-E-T. Revolution.us. All right? And just write to Mark, I love Jim. Be back in a second.
Mark. Wait. Oh, jeez. Now he's been to the mountaintop and needs a nap. Mark Maron.
I got tired last night. I do need a nap. I couldn't barely do anything last night and ended up blogging. I was blogging with the folks.
I was reading a lot of those blogs, yes.
Yeah,
I just wanted to see how far you
MRD go. And NYC can EATME. You understand what I'm saying?
You really got into it. I saw that. I mean,
I felt a little dirty afterwards.
Yeah.
I felt a little dirty. She, whoever that is, I thought that I knew who MRD and NYC was, but I don't know if it was. The person I knew was a nicer person and didn't say things like, Don't you think Mark Maron's interviewing ability was much better on the morning's edition show? I really have to give Mark Riley more credit for keeping Mark Maron in line. It seems, and I'm paraphrasing, see how insecure I am? See what buttons I have that I just leave open?
Man, you just,
because I keep an open heart, Jim.
That left an indelible mark on your memory. That was word for word.
I walk through the world with my heart on my sleeve because that's how I want to see the world. And it also makes me very volatile. And reactionary and completely...
This is great, man, because I'm just going to start coming on that blog, too, as you know, somebody... You know, like,
start picking away at me? But I told you that story about...
D-Boy 8.
I told you that...
What's wrong with Mark, anyway? You know, it's interviewing...
She knew what she was doing. Then she brings up Sue Ellicott, and it was like, bang! And I was in. Yeah, that was much better.
You know what? I think the perfect show would be Mark Riley and Sue Ellicott.
Oh, they can have that show.
What's this all Mark Maron stuff? Yeah.
It's called Watching Paint Dry in the morning. Who wants to watch paint dry in the morning?
You know, you're a painter.
I'm not dissing Riley. I'm dissing Sue. Sue was like, whatever the case. It was an experiment. I wish her all the best. But I did not get along with her.
So are you going to go on the blog in the future?
I felt kind of ashamed of myself because I was just kind of bored. And, you know, there's something weird about listening to me on the radio and watching people listen to me and talk about what I'm saying and then get involved in the conversation. There's something a little pathetic about it. Mm-hmm. My wife is in her office working, and I'm sitting there, talking to some guy with the word Norton in his name about comedy, which I don't mind talking to these people. These are our fans. Though I did get a little prickly because I personally feel that the interviews we do on this show are much more personal. They come from my brain and my heart.
You don't have to explain.
I know I'm not explaining. And it all started with what's his name? Jonathan Alter and his peculiar comment about teachers unions, which is like just it was completely out of left field and made no sense. And I don't know if I handled it well. I didn't know what the hell he was talking about.
Do you think you attacked him enough? Do you think you should have attacked him? Do you think you should have just kind of got in there, you know?
It was one of those things he kind of slipped in, you know, like, you know, that it was like, bang, all of a sudden the teachers union is like the religious right to the Democrats. I'm like, what is that about? And I needed to know what his angle was. And I believe teachers should make more money. And I believe that accountability, it's not relative to that. I mean, you know, holding people accountable has no point of reference in, you know, whether or not they hold teachers accountable or whatever. That was some sort of, you know, out and left field point. But I did not know the nuances of what he was talking about in terms of states and in terms of principals and in terms of hiring and firing of teachers. I don't know. Sometimes unions... are not always necessarily right in their intent, but I don't know that to be true about the teachers union. I just didn't know enough about it, so I didn't. But I guess as a radio personality, that shouldn't stop me from saying, "Whoa, dude, you're an ass, and you can go stick it in it." You know, I mean, it shouldn't stop me from saying that without having any foundation whatsoever. Maybe I was too light on him, but I was not intimidated by his credentials. I just didn't know what the hell he was talking about. Now I've talked too much about this.
See, I think Sue Ellicott would have just, you know, gone right to the point there. But, you know, that's,
Sue
Ellicott, that's all academic.
Whoa.
That's
Sue Ellicott going right to the point about anything? Please.
Do we have the short order news coming up?
Do you remember that show? Right to the point?
Oh,
are we talking
man.
About the same person?
Oh, man. She was great.
At going right to the point?
She was great.
Really? Do you know that we had a word in it, describing what she did?
No, what?
It was Ellicotting. Do you want me to give an example of Ellicotting? Okay, so now the teachers union. Now, is that a union comprised primarily of teachers who teach, say, elementary school or high school? Or is it primarily, does it deal with both elementary and high school? And if so, how big are these schools, generally speaking, in terms of the unions? Would it be important to know the numbers of students that are represented by the teachers in terms of in understanding what the union? You understand? See where you wherever you just were. That was me every morning for as long as that went on for. Man, I'm in trouble. All right, look, folks, we don't want you to be caught off guard. Player hating. You know what this is a sign of?
What?
Same thing that your little song was a sign of. There's trouble in paradise, my friends. Good look around.
Morning yesterday.
See that? See those? See the palm trees?
Mm.
I don't know how long that's going to last. Republican Senator Charles Grassley of Iowa is hoping to stamp out the sex trade by taxing pimps and prostitutes, then jailing them when they don't pay. Grassley's proposal requires all sex workers to give the IRS a 1069. In response, prostitutes all over the country said they resented being targeted by the Senate after all they've done for Congress. A constitutional amendment to ban flag desecration died in a Senate cliffhanger, a single vote short of the support needed to send it to the states. In spite of the close vote, if someone invents a car that runs on flag burning and flags are cheaper than $3 a gallon, most Americans are all for it. And also, thank God, now I don't have to cancel my 4th of July flag-a-queue. No good. We roasting them up. The ones that have left from yesterday. I'm gonna wrap weenies and American flags. I'm probably gonna grill some fish in them. You know, if you wrap a piece of salmon in an American flag and then cover it in foil and throw it on the grill,
mm-hmm.
It's a great. It's called all American salmon. That's the recipe.
Tastes like desecration.
Yeah. Or you can make tamales and use instead of a corn husk, perhaps an American flag. Singer Boy George was threatened with jail by a New York judge for failing to complete a community service requirement because he wanted to do something less humiliating than raking leaves. Boy George was worried about the media frenzy his leaf raking will cause. Yeah, a cross-dressing drug addict carrying a rake in Central Park is big news. Big news. Yeah.
Ellicott.
The judge brushed aside Boy George's concerns about being humiliated by reminding him what he looked like in the 80s. That's a mean one. Boy George.
Hey, if you dress like that, accept the jokes.
There was a guy that used to do a joke in Boston when I was doing open mics. He'd go, "Boy George, do you really want to hurt me?" Yeah.
I remember that guy.
Yeah.
Man, that was... What a horrible joke.
It's the worst. Boy George does a duet on that Anthony and the Johnsons album. That's quite nice. I've given this guy a lot of press. I'd like to have him on the show, I guess. Tomorrow we got Jack Boulware, Matt Whitecross, the Road to Guantanamo movie, John Landis, the director, and Hard and Firm, Chris Hardwick and the other guy to do musical comedy. Good night, Chief.